This is the Applying Sports Science Podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Greenwood, and it's great to have you here as part of the podcast family. Presented by the Human Performance Center as part of the College of Health Sciences at the University of Memphis, we're here to talk about all things sport, science, and the real things that contribute to athlete success. And if you want the cheap notes, it's about more than just the science. In episode 4, we chat to Georgia Giblin, the Director of Performance Science at the Detroit Tigers Major League Baseball team. With a strong background in biomechanics and skill acquisition science, her ability to understand, measure, and analyze is unquestionable. But rather, it's her ability to discuss, share, and impact athletes and coaches that is her true superpower. Georgia provides some awesome insight based on her own experiences with coaches and athletes, but also from her experiences trying to understand the needs and wants of coaches within an organization of hundreds of players amidst the hectic reality of a 162-game regular season. As always, we'll delve into her thoughts and opinions and lesson learned about applying sports science to help us all be better at what we do and ensure we make a real difference to athletic performance. Here we go. G'day, Georgia. How you doing?
I'm doing good, thanks, Dan.
Happy to have you on board. Thanks for coming and chatting and, sharing your wisdom, advice and what else do you want to share with us today?
Happy to share.
I think I want to start somewhere really general, and that is working in sports science cool?
It depends. absolutely, it's cool. But it, like every job, it has its moments. I think, when you go through undergrad and you start going through sports science, you think about the cool scenarios. You think about, standing on the sidelines, watching games, being part of a team. You don't probably think about the not so cool scenarios of, well, after the game, there's 3 hours of data analysis to be taken care of, or the long hours, weekends away, lots of travel, those sorts of things. But I mean, all in all, it's pretty cool. I mean, you get to watch sport and work with the best of the best athletes on a daily basis. So yeah, can't complain too much.
Absolutely. So we agreed that we are now cool nerds working in sport. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I would say so.
All right. Excellent. And do you think sports science is anything like you thought it was going to be when you started out on this journey?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know that I really had a good preconception about what sports science was. I was one of those kids that went through school, didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I was really good at physics and maths and I love sport. So I kind of landed in sports science and, to be honest, kind of never really thought too much beyond that. And then I just kind of, just landed on my feet, I guess, in terms of working in sports science. But I mean, for me right now, I think of it as an applied job, because that's probably all, I've really been exposed to, but obviously there is other aspects to it. But I mean, I probably, like most people, thought of only the cool aspects, not necessarily a lot of the other aspects that go along with it. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Everything answers every question, Georgia. let's do the, you're an Australian now living in the US. I mean, obviously sports science has opened that opportunity for you. Is US sport as exciting as you were hoping it was going to be?
It's definitely exciting. I think the scheme of things is just, it's so much bigger. I mean, just to put it into perspective here, I mean, we have 300 odd players, in our organization to deal with. And that's insane. I mean, imagine, a sport in Australia dealing with 300 track and field athletes. Like, there just isn't that depth. But over here there is, there's depth of talent and there's also money to back it up as well. So it is it is exciting. And obviously too, you know, we have the pinnacle of a lot of sports over here as well. So being able to see some of those, you know, players work through the system and get to that pinnacle of their sport here is pretty exciting.
You talked about sort of almost stumbling into this job or sort of falling into it semi-accidentally. Do you have a memory of the things you actually did do right for those opportunities to turn up in your lap?
Yeah, when I think about that, I kind of think about actually like networking. And I think this is one of the probably the keys for young sports scientists in my mind, purely just because I feel like at every stage of my career, I can link it not to necessarily what I've done. Obviously, that's a huge part of it, because if you don't do, you know, a good job, you're never really going to progress too far. But more about like who I've surrounded myself with, who I've had opportunities to work with. It's almost like a clear kind of transition from, okay, I was at university and I really wanted to get into biomechanics. And so I had the opportunity to do my honours and research in field hockey biomechanics. And my supervisor there, well, his best mate was at the AIS, and he was working in applied sports at the AIS. And so I was introduced, you know, to the Australian Institute of Sport through him, and had an opportunity to do an internship there. And then when I was in that role, I was able to meet more like biomechanists and sports scientists who had more opportunities for me. And, you know, that led to me doing my PhD. And then from my PhD, obviously led me to Queensland. And I feel as though like at every step of the way, there was some sort of relationship, or everyone was kind of connected. Like sports science, it's popular, but particularly in Australia, it's not a huge discipline, I guess. And so for me, I think I can almost trace it to like the people, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, 100% it makes sense. I often feel like networking sounds like a dirty word. It's like you're almost like you're seeking people who have already succeeded and just trying to like latch onto them like some sort of monster or something. But I like to think of networking. I think the word you used was more accurate, was relationship building. Is that, do you think that's fair? Do you know how Georgia Giblin networks?
Yeah, I think I've kind of also thought about this with regards to sport, and it kind of links into one of the other aspects I think that makes a good sports scientist is your ability to create relationships. And a lot of that, I think, within sport, there's a huge ability you need to have to fit into a team environment or whatever environment that is. And I feel like for me, you know, I was very successful because I think, you know, I obviously work hard, but I have that ability to create relationships with a variety of people. You know, whether that's your other interns, whether that's your supervisor, whether that's your track and field coach or your rowing coach. And I think that's a, you know, a huge aspect of being successful.
Just so when you say fitting in, does that mean, is that personally and professionally, or are you talking more just about those personal sort of relationships?
Both, I think. I mean, I think both are important. Obviously you need to be professional. But I think, I mean, to give you an example of what I'm trying to explain, I guess, in terms of in baseball, we have this terminology called feel, right? And the coaches and the staff, they, you know, they talk about it all the time. It's like, oh, that guy's got no feel. And you could be the best person at your job. You could be the best analyst, but if you have no feel, it doesn't get you very far. And so, I guess feel is probably, you know, just awareness of like your surroundings and the people you're dealing with and the circumstances. So a good example that came up the other day was, all right, we're playing a game. It's a really long game. After the game, the players have like a post-game spread and they get their food. We have some young staff members and all right, they're clocked out for the day. They're finished. They've done their workout, shower. They come in and they just start crushing the post-game spread while the game's still going. The players are still working. The coaches are still going and just don't think anything of it. So things like that, I think, no one teaches you that and no one probably tells you that, but that's lack of feel, shall we say.
Those listening, my mouth is like on the floor. Yeah, I can't imagine a coach or a player's face when they would look at me like hoeing into their food.
Exactly. And that's what I mean, just kind of, knowing your place sounds bad, I guess, but I guess being aware of, some of those sorts of things make a difference.
It's funny you say knowing your place, because I think that's one of the hardest parts of sports science is that sometimes the people you're working with haven't worked with sports scientists before, so they don't really know how you're supposed to fit or operate. And how do you see yourself in relation to coaches and athletes? Are you partner, like expert, friend? How do you see yourself fitting in?
I kind of like to think of myself as a bit of a support act. So exactly what you just mentioned, like a lot of the technology that we're using right now in baseball is pretty new. So a lot of the coaches don't necessarily know how to use it or the best way to use it. And so the way that I'm trying to go about navigating those waters is to say, I'm here to support you and I'm here to help you answer any questions that you have. So I'm not here to, dictate that like this is how things should be done. So for example, if you see a player and you think that this is happening in their technique and your eyes tell you that, absolutely, I can help you validate or verify that. And if, vice versa, if you have a player and you're telling them something and they don't believe you, but we can show some data or something to back up your point of view and help, convey the message to the player so they understand, then we can use sports science in that way. But I think that's definitely one of the things that's kind of really tricky to navigate. And it depends a lot on the people that you're working with, so the coaches and the players. And again, that's one of those feel situations, right? Some coaches just want, all right, well, you're the expert. You tell me what I should know. And other coaches are like, well, I don't want a bar of that. So you just stay over there in your lab and don't come out here to the field. And, some people are in the middle ground and you just kind of have to navigate the best you can.
And I think that's really important that, as a sports scientist, you do have to have that feel of what somebody almost pre-thinks you're going to do so that you can approach conversations and information that way. I remember being asked, which one would I prefer to work with? The one that, I can almost show them the light and, evolve their coaching to include science, or the one that's hyper-enthusiastic but maybe not as good a coach. Do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I would say I think it's more challenging to work with the coaches that don't use technology or sports science. And so then perhaps, it's a little bit more rewarding when they do see the light at the end of the tunnel or they see some of the value that you can add. And, maybe it's only a small win here or there. It doesn't need to be something that's incorporated every day or all the time. To be honest, you get both, right? So you obviously have to learn how to deal with both of those scenarios.
I thought it was interesting you talk about the small wins. I feel like sometimes I struggle as a sports scientist to almost, I sometimes feel like I need to change the world or I need to like change the whole organization through my awesome approach or technology or experience.
Yeah.
You're laughing. Yeah, fill me in on your laughter.
Oh, I feel like that's a really common thought that a lot of people have that's like, all right, I'm going to come in here and I'm going to change the world. And you know, especially in sports or in organizations that have never had sports science, I feel as though I probably have that expectation of myself as well. And you have that as well. But what I've learned over the past few years is that that's definitely not necessarily the case. And coming into organizations that don't necessarily have a huge background in sports science is they don't necessarily know what they're looking for. And so sometimes it is just, all right, well, we can make this more efficient, or, you know, we can do this slightly differently for a better result. And those small wins are just stepping stones. And sometimes I think, man, I've been here, you know, almost 3 years and I haven't really achieved a lot because there's no one huge thing that stands out, you know. But then I think, all right, no, well, we've introduced that, we've changed this, that process is completely different now, or we've changed the way we do this because of, you know, something that we found out. Realistically, it's the small things that add up to not even one big thing, but just better all around. Yeah, one of the things I think we talk about here within our performance department, which includes, you know, the medical staff and the strength and conditioning and, you know, some groups from analytics and things, is what's the low-hanging fruit? You know, what can we tackle and what can we achieve that's going to give us small gains that's relatively, you know, easy to implement, as opposed to, all right, what's the grand plan, you know, which is, maybe we have a grand plan in the back of our head, but what can we tackle, you know, right now? Or what's the low-hanging fruit?
Is that about gaining approval of the coach, or is that about sort of giving you time to settle into the organization, or is that more just a really important thing to almost get those basics right?
I think it's a combination. So obviously getting the basics right, I think, is really important, and that should be the first step. But there's certainly an aspect of gaining approval of the coaches, but also of the front office. So a lot of the coaches, as I mentioned before, they're not used to some of these technology, these processes. So it's a big change for them. So I think drip feeding it in is a little bit smarter of an approach than overwhelming them, because obviously once you overwhelm them, and then if they feel stupid or that they can't handle it or something, then there's no coming back from that, right? And then secondly, the front office plays a big part in terms of running the whole organization, budgets, things like that. So there's also always that kind of aspect of, you know, there's the boots on the ground, but we need to prove that what we're doing is useful, actually helping the organization to improve, so that, you know, we can continue to build that trust in those relationships, so that, you know, if we do want to do a big picture, you know, spend a lot of money on a big something that's going to change the world, well, maybe there's a chance for it.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I'm with you. I'm with you. We've talked a lot about, I guess, that phrase sports science and sports scientists. I like to ask, what are three words that you associate with a good sports scientist, and what are three words that you associate with a bad sports scientist?
Okay. Well, I mean, along similar lines to what we just talked about, one of my big ones is feel. So you can throw that one on the list. I would also associate with a good sports scientist someone that is conscientious or has really good attention to detail. Obviously, we deal, well, maybe not everyone, but most people deal a lot with numbers and, you know, people are making decisions off some of this information. So obviously it needs to be correct. So attention to detail is a big one for me. And then probably adaptable would be a good one. So if I've learned anything in sport, very rarely do things go to plan. So even, you know, you can have the best laid out plan or a schedule for the day, and oh, all of a sudden it starts raining, or, you know, someone forgot one camera and the coach really needs too. So you need to be able to be adaptable and think on your feet. I think that's probably a very critical skill.
I'm chuckling at the idea of adaptability because it is so true. That perfectly planned week that you have for testing and support of athletes and, you know, applying things just at the right time, the speed at which it can just completely implode and just look like something completely different is astonishing.
Yeah, it is phenomenal. And even small things like, you know, you've packed everything and you've got everything sorted and you get to where you're going to and there's no Wi-Fi or, you know, there's no power or just like anything that could go wrong probably will go wrong when you're trying to like organize a testing session or have something really important going on. So being able to adapt and probably problem solve would be top of that list as well. Is very, very important in my book.
One of the great skills I learned traveling with our track and field athletes around Europe was the ability to sweet talk security guards and sweet talk event organizers to allow me to stand in certain places to film races and record data. If it wasn't for that ability to sweet talk, then I would have been standing outside a stadium whilst athletes were running while I was supposed to be collecting data.
There you go. Good use of your skill.
Exactly. I didn't get taught that one at uni.
Because in terms of you want the bad?
Give me one sec because I want to pick up on that idea of making decisions off data because I think I think sometimes we don't almost understand how important the data is, if that makes sense. Like this, to me, it can change, you know, people's lives, people's career trajectories. You know, as you said, people make decisions based on this data. I'd like to sort of hear about, I guess, how you feel responsible for that, both in terms of the data and then how it's used.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's an interesting way to think about it, I guess, in terms of in sport, the difference sometimes between winning and losing is just so incredibly minute that if you think about it on that scale and some of the changes that we're making or we're measuring are so miniature that it can have such a big impact. So I guess for me, it's just really important that you have good data integrity in order to make some of those decisions, because the last thing that I want is for a coach to say, hey, I pulled this guy from the game, or I did this, or, you know, I changed this in their technique because you said this, and for that not to be true. So I think that's obviously why it's important to make sure that everything you have is valid and reliable and that, you know, you've checked it twice, three times, whatever you need to do to make sure that whatever you're passing along to the coach is accurate. And, you know, as well as I do, sometimes you can pass along information with the best intention in mind and they take it and run with it in a completely different direction. That's been known to happen as well. So I think you've just got to be aware of what you're collecting and how it gets used.
Yeah, that idea of that data integrity speaks really strongly to me, especially that in terms of understanding what tech is actually measuring and what constitutes a change is really important. You know, is that just noise in the data, or is that a real change? There's a real art to being able to explain that to coaches and to athletes when they are looking for really small differences.
Yeah, exactly. And I think too, you know, quite often I'll have a coach who wants to come in and just look at, you know, one thing and it's one sample of five swings. It's like, I mean, we can 100% do that if you're looking at something for today, but just know that, you know, that's not going to give us a really reflective, you know, sample of what that athlete's doing, because obviously with certain technologies and different technology, there may be some noise in there and you might need more trials to be able to understand fully what that movement is. And so that's, I guess, something that coaches don't think about, nor they're paid to think about, but that's something that we obviously have to, you know, take into consideration and educate them on if possible.
It's interesting you say that, because I feel like we've both come from sports where potentially sometimes you can't get a lot of samples or something, whereas now you're in baseball and you spend some time in softball where they do have bigger samples. Has that been a change in mindset for you, or is that just, did you always think like that?
Probably not. No, I think probably coming to baseball has been very interesting because they play so often. They work out every day. You know, the schedule is just completely different to, say, working with an Olympic athlete where, you know, their training is very structured for a 4-year cycle and they have their meets that they want to achieve and very planned out. Like, this is a testing week, or, you know, it's very, so you have a small window of opportunity. Whereas, you know, we have a 182 game season. We have a lot of opportunities to collect data in games or, you know, before games, after games, during spring training. So it is, I think, just a completely different mindset. And when I first arrived here, that was one of the things that everybody just kept telling me, and not specifically related to data or testing or anything, that just baseball is a different animal. Like, whatever you think about other sports and how other sports do things, it just doesn't apply to baseball because of scheduling and travel and just everything.
Were they right?
Obviously, like in some regards, you know, they certainly were, and it is a different sport to work with, and there is a lot of challenges that come with the schedule. But then obviously, like I mentioned, there is some bonuses. There's plenty of information.
the peril of every sports scientist, which is I'm just collecting some data, or I just need a bit more data. Sometimes I worry when there's almost too many opportunities to collect data, because I almost won't be harsh enough on myself in terms of either my rigor or my making sure I'm asking the right question.
Yeah, I think that's certainly a challenge, that if you're doing this and it happens to be every day, you know, making sure that you have everything set up the same way and you have that same process every day and that data is, you know, it's being collected in the same manner and it's repeatable, right? And once you do it day on day on day, you know, sometimes those standards, I guess, can slip.
I think that speaks to that conscientious idea. Like, it is truly important that you do have that almost, I wouldn't call it like obsessive, but there is a level of detail required to be an applied sports scientist where, you know, sport may be chaos and it may be adaptable, but you as a sports scientist collecting data do have to be conscientious in what you're doing to make sure that things are done right and properly.
Yeah, without a doubt. And, you know, sometimes I find myself in a challenging situation where it's really hard to maintain those standards. And I think, you know, the reverse is also true in that, okay, sometimes I have to give a little bit and say, okay, look, this is not going to be maybe as applicable as it should be because, all right, we're going to do it now indoors and they're going to wear different shoes than they would normally wear or whatever. And so sometimes I have to give up some of those standards, which is fine so long as, you know, that gets communicated with the coaches, you know, like, all right, like, here's my ideal world of how we would collect this. And this is how you want to do it. Like, let's meet halfway. We'll still be able to get some really good data. It's not going to be game-like or it's not going to be perfect, but it'll go bridge that gap, you know?
It's interesting to say that, because I feel like that's one of the things that we aren't taught as scientists at school is, or even as we're studying, that idea that just because it's no longer gold standard doesn't mean it's not useful.
Yeah, I would agree. And we've had conversations internally about, you know, some of the technology that is really popular in sports at the moment. And obviously we have gold standards in movement capture, you know, things like marker movement capture, Vicon, Qualisys, things like that. But they're not practical to use on a daily basis in some sports or in a lot of sports. And so, you know, we go and we use things like accelerometers. They may not be as accurate. They definitely don't do, you know, some of the things as well as we would like them to do. But at the end of the day, it does provide us with some information that we can't necessarily get otherwise. And I think as a scientist, so long as you understand like the validity and like how reliable that tech is, and that it's not going to be perfect, but if you're using that same piece of technology in the same way every day and you're comparing apples to apples and I'm just comparing with that one athlete, then, you know, maybe it has its place. So I think there is, you know, there's a lot of compromises to be made.
But I think it's important to understand that those compromises aren't necessarily a bad thing.
No, not at all. Not at all. And to be honest, like in applied sports, it happens on a daily basis. Like it's something that needs to be done. It's like, all right, I go out and I want to do six senses on this guy. Oh, he's not feeling it. Just put on two because it takes less time. Yeah, there's those types of compromises. And then there's, you know, the technology data side of compromises as well. And they happen every day, and it's just something that you kind of learn to deal with and work through.
And it's interesting that you talked about the relationships with the coaches. You have to have that ability to communicate with them. Yeah, kind of what they may be giving up, for lack of a better word, in terms of doing it this way. But I guess being knowledgeable as a scientist and being personable enough to sort of have that honest conversation and say, yeah, that's fair. Like, you know, that's not a big deal, but understand that this is what we're giving up. We could do this better. I think I guess what I'm trying to say is it does come back to having that relationship as well. You're not just the scientist at that point, right? You're part of the team.
Yeah. I think that it goes a long way, obviously, being able to have that relationship with the coach, but then also, you know, have a little bit of experience within the sport and know the demands or, you know, what that coach might be thinking as to why we have to change things around, right? And just being able to put yourselves in their shoes and understand, okay, all right, I get where he's coming from. I'll give him my point of view, and then maybe next time when we have more time or it's a slightly different scenario or circumstance, we can try and do it more towards the way that, you know, would be a gold standard or give us more, you know, better information. But I definitely think you're right there. Having that relationship and being able to work through those scenarios is really key.
I feel like to be as successful as you've been in sports science, that relationship building really is a fundamental skill or process, maybe. Do you have an awareness of what your process is when you first meet a coach or an athlete to sort of turn from blank face sports scientist into Georgia?
I don't know that I have a great awareness of it myself. I do know that what my initial process is in terms of, all right, so I've come into baseball, very aware that I haven't worked in baseball. I have never played baseball. And a lot of the coaches that we have around here have played Major League Baseball for a significant amount of time, been very successful. So I'm very mindful when I first come in to just be a sponge. So I obviously know that, you know, maybe the organization's had other sports science initiatives before. Maybe they've had other sports scientists. I'm not here to, you know, step on anyone's toes. I'm here to help everybody. And so in order to do that, I like to just kind of sit back and listen and take in everything that's going on before I try and, you know, actually start to build in some of the, you know, the directions and processes and technology and things that I might want to implement. So I think that's one of the things that I do. And then I've been told that I ask a lot of questions.
You've been told.
So while I was asked a similar question like this in one of my performance reviews about what do I think makes me a good sports scientist, and I don't know what my answer was, but my supervisor at the time said, well, I think one of your really good strengths is you ask good questions. You ask coaches good questions. You ask other staff good questions. And that leads to a lot of good discussions and projects and things. I was like, oh, okay. So apparently I ask good questions.
Do you have any concept what constitutes a good question?
That's a good question. I feel as though in that regard, it was about getting people to think outside of what they typically would do. And specifically in baseball, I know that that's been a big key in terms of, all right, you know, historically we've done things this way, and without telling you that that's wrong, because it might not be wrong, but without sort of passing judgment, like, why are you doing it that way? Why have you done it that way? Have you thought about doing this? And have you thought about maybe implementing this or changing this? So just, I guess, getting people to think about things in a different light without necessarily challenging them too much.
To me, that speaks to such a truth that it's not really the question that you ask, but it's the way you ask the question, which I think is a huge part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I know plenty of people that have, you know, come into organizations and just come in hot, so to speak, and, you know, they're trying to get their way from the get-go, don't listen to what's been done in the past, and then, you know, asking those types of questions, but in a very, like, almost accusational manner, right? And that just, it doesn't get you very far.
The way you speak about that, there's a real sort of humbleness and sincerity in that, those sort of questions that you're asking. But I feel like, you came to the Tigers to sort of start a sports science program. It must have been a bit terrifying to not try to change the world from the start, right? Or was that not even a thought?
Yeah, I don't know that that was ever a thought, to be honest. I mean, I came in and I had no idea what they had done previously. So I needed to understand that and see where the organization was at. But I don't think I've ever gone anywhere and thought, oh, I'm going to change the world, or I'm going to work with this athlete and they're going to be the best athlete they've ever been. And obviously some people, they do think that. And when you're an elite sports person, probably thinking like that is a bonus, right? Like, but well, in some instances, to be honest, I don't know that I had kind of ever thought like that. I was more of a, all right, come in, take stock, let's see where we're at, and, you know, what's the first thing we can do to move this forward.
I love it. Absolutely love it. So I derailed you a little while ago. You were going to tell me the three things that your three words you associate with bad sports scientists.
Okay. Well, I guess based on that last little conversation
you exactly where I wanted you. Huh?
Yeah. Well done. I think having obviously an ego is a bit of a can be a challenging thing. And like I said, you know, when you come into an organization and try and dictate, I guess, how things you think things should go, and you're not open-minded. So someone that doesn't have that kind of growth mindset, the open mindset, I think that's that I would associate with the bad sports scientist. Somebody that is disorganized, I think that's probably not good either. I mean, sport moves at a pretty rapid pace, and like, if you want to keep on top of your data and make sure that that's, you know, valid and reliable, like we talked about, I think organization is a huge key. And then one of the things that I've kind of, this goes into a lot about what we've talked about before, and maybe I have a lot bundled into this kind of feel category. But again, not, I guess, I don't want to say not knowing your place, because that sounds terrible, but I guess not understanding where you would fit in, like, the greater scheme of things. Like, earlier you asked about, you know, where I see myself fitting it in terms of, like, my relationship with the coaches and things. And I think probably not understanding that would be a challenge for you to be a good sports scientist.
Yeah,
that was really long-winded, sorry.
No, that's perfect. That's perfect. That's exactly what I was hoping for. I totally agree. You spoke as well about the idea of, you know, you work for a baseball team, but you don't necessarily know a lot about baseball. There's a preconception that you do need to know a lot about a sport to contribute to a sport as a sports scientist. Do you think that's true?
Yes and no. And let's back up here. I now know a lot about baseball. I've learned a lot in the past couple of years. But so yes and no. I was asked in my interview for this job, how would I deal with coaches and players who know that I've never played a game of baseball in my life? And I said to my now boss, oh, I didn't realize the laws of physics changed depending on the sport you played. It's probably a little cheeky thing to say, yeah. I probably didn't word it exactly like that, but that was the drift. So I think, you know, if you have a solid understanding of the principles of sports science, then you can take them and you can apply them to any sport. So having not worked in baseball, you know, a lot of the techniques that I'd learnt in undergrad or that I was using in track and field or triathlon, I can still use in baseball. So a lot of that, I think, transfers, and obviously all that underlying science transfers and is the same. Where I do think you need to know a little bit about sport is, again, fitting into the sport. So if you're going to be a sports scientist for a baseball team and you organize testing at 8 a.m. after the team's been on the road for 7 days and they just got back at 2 a.m. the night before, you're probably not going to be very popular. So I think you need to know it in situations like that. And then, you know, even in more general situations where, all right, you might have done like generic testing, let's say vertical jump testing, kind of applies to any sport. You know, you're really good at that. But then the players turn around and say, okay, well, how does this relate to my hitting? Or how does this relate to my pitching? You know, you need to be able to, I think, link some of those concepts to the sport itself. So I don't think necessarily you need to know everything from the get-go. But obviously having an understanding of the sports and at least the demands of the sports is pretty important.
And I think you alluded to it there, understanding the lingo as well is another one, where just learning what people mean by certain words as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, some sports are very complex in terms of, like, if you were to look at pitching and all the pitch metrics that come out of, you know, one piece of technology that we use, it's overwhelming. But yeah, if I came in here and I was like, wow, that's a great rise ball you've got there to one of the pitches, they'd probably be like, ooh, all right, I'm no longer going to listen to anything that this woman has to say.
To me, you just have to almost embrace who you are and what you know, rather than, I think you get in trouble when you try to pretend, right?
Yeah, 100%, 100%.
I remember I in an effort to fit in at one point in time, I bought some new shoes so that I would look more like the sport I was working with, and it turned out I bought ones that were not cool and not appropriate for that sport. So my attempts to be part of the crew didn't work, and I was much better off just being myself and just say, hey, this is me. And like you said, I don't necessarily know a whole lot about this at the moment, but I don't need to help you achieve whatever it is your goal is.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think, you know, once you establish those relationships with the players and you gain their trust, you know, then you can actually flip the script on them and be like, hey, So you're working on your fastball today. Like, what sort of spin rate are you trying to achieve? And if you don't know, that's fine. And, you know, they're pretty intelligent guys, these, you know, these players, and they're trying to be the best they can as well. So I found too that, you know, they're open to having those conversations with you, and they'd much rather you ask them questions and talk to you about their process and what they're trying to achieve than you trying to be like, oh, so, you know, basically trying to fake your way through it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really do. The longer I've been in sport, well, not even the longer, just I really do think athletes get a bad rap for not being bright. I really think that they know so much about what they're doing and their sport. I sometimes just think they don't get asked the questions about it so people can almost see how much they know about what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's obviously different scales of athletes in terms of, you know, how much they even want to talk about that, right? So some of them could be just absolutely elite in their sport, but you could ask questions that, oh, I don't want to figure out it, I just do it, you know? And that's some people's mentality. And then you get the other people that almost overanalyze, you know, you could ask them every single fine detail, like, all right, what's your game plan on race day? Well, at 7:15, I get up, I eat this, I do this, you know, and it's a completely different process. So I think that probably goes into one of the other, you know, I think really important aspects of being a sports scientist is knowing who you're dealing with. So sometimes, you know, we'll be outside on the bullpens and, you know, we track their bullpens in terms of, let's say, just velocity, spin, all those pitch metrics. And some of the players will turn around and be like, hey, what was this? What was that? And then other players are like, don't you dare show me that iPad, you know? So you need to kind of understand who you're dealing with and what their preferences are. And some of them will talk your ear off about their data for 2 hours. And then others are like, no, you look at it and tell me what you think I need to improve. Give me two bullet points and we'll go from there. You know, it's just everyone's different.
And to me, it just comes from you having a good feel for those people, as you said, but also good understanding of that data so that you can I feel like one of the strengths of an applied sports scientist is that ability to either, I almost call it like stretch or simplify the report. Like, can you sum it up for me in a bullet point or can you write a 10-page report? I feel like an applied scientist can do both.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. I think, you know, typically when I do reports, I always do a couple of versions. I do like a player-facing version and then I do like a front office version. And those are very different because obviously the audience is very different. Yeah. So the front office might want to know, you know, what we're doing with the technology, how we're using it, maybe some use cases, and that player wants to know specifically for them, you know, what they can achieve, what they're working on, you know, what they can improve, things like that. So I think that's definitely a big skill. And again, probably not something that we're taught in university. Like anything we're taught, I think report-wise was probably very clinical in terms of like, here's the data, here's the numbers, not necessarily who your audience is and how you can change that report based on your audience. I mean, I know you'll get feedback from coaches very quickly if they don't like what's in your report. Well, I want a bar graph, not a line graph, and I don't want a table with numbers. You know, like you learn very quickly what people's preferences are. But I definitely think that's, you know, a really important skill to have.
I remember one Gary Bourne telling me that he did not want his reports updated in that manner.
Yes, they can be very particular, that's for sure.
How do you balance, I guess, your I guess I'm going to call them scientific truths with a coach who maybe disagrees with you? How, if you see like a sort of non-negotiable, maybe as far as you see it, that a coach simply either won't buy into, what do I want to say? You and a coach, okay, let's create a scenario. You and a coach disagree about something. You think it's a non-negotiable that an athlete should change something and they don't. How do you almost deal with that as a concept?
I feel like that probably happens quite a lot. So the way I would approach it would be obviously to have that conversation with the coach and just get an understanding of, you know, why they don't think it's an issue. Just for my information. And then I would go about it by probably trying to collect some data to validate my opinion or my perspective. And I would try and present that to them. Like, obviously I don't want to do it in a way where I say like, hey, look, I'm right. I want to do it in a way and that's like, all right, like I understand where you're coming from. And obviously, you know, you've probably done it that way for 20 years and have been very successful. I want you to think maybe just about if we were to change this, this is what we might see. And, you know, I think based on some of the numbers that if we make this change, it's going to be worthwhile because, you know, A, B, and C. That's probably how I would approach it. Whether that coach then goes, all right, good idea, Georgia, or they go, all right, Georgia, shut the hell up. See you later. You know, it is what it is. And I don't think, like, you're never going to win all of those battles. Some people, I think, especially coaches that have had success doing things the way that they've always done them, you know, they might not change their mind. And I think the other interesting point is, like, every athlete's going to be different too. So maybe it works for that one athlete that they have. Maybe if they have juniors coming up through the ranks, that's where you're like, okay, I really would like to change that aspect for these kids coming through in the development process. So how about we try it with so-and-so and we'll see how it goes. And, you know, if you don't like the results, all right, fine. You know, we'll go back to your way. But if we can trial it with, you know, these people and maybe it's positive, well, maybe we've started to kind of shift in that direction. I don't know. I don't know if there's any kind of black and white, always the kind of give and take.
Yeah, but I think sometimes, as you're alluding to, I think the changes aren't as big as sometimes we might make them out to be. Like, I've ever asked a coach to completely shift their coaching methodology based on data or based on my scientific opinion or based on scientific opinion. That's probably not a phrase. my scientific process.
Yeah.
I think sometimes I think we alluded to at the start, we sometimes only need small changes to actually make a really positive impact, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I think that, you know, is worthwhile is bringing in other people. Like, if this is a small change that you think needs to be made for like a health reason, for example, like, all right, if you keep running that way, you're going to get a stress fracture or, you know, it's just going to lead to injury. Like, bringing in, you know, medical staff with background and knowledge, I think can help too. But you're right. I think you can make one small adjustment and, you know, perhaps that cleans up a few other things as well. You just, you never know.
What can sports scientists or support staff sort of as a fraternity, so to speak, what can we do better as a whole to improve the perceptions or applications or use of our industry? Let's call it that.
Yeah, that's a tough one. The internships, I think, are a big part of it. And, I mean, I was very, very lucky to go through a great program at the Australian Institute of Sport. And, I mean, I firmly believe that set up the foundation for me being able to work in such a good environment with good supervisors. So I think that plays a huge part of it. And I know that other aspects, like, struggle with that, the internship program in terms of, you know, overworking people, underpaying and not providing adequate supervision. And it is one of those things that you need to go through that process to begin your journey in sports science. So I think just making sure that we have that, those programs and like in place, but in place in the right way. And then I don't know. I forgot what your question was now.
That's perfect. I was going to say, do you remember what you learnt as a junior sports scientist during your internship?
Specifically?
Maybe generally. I don't know.
Well, I did learn a few skills that I think I have 100% used. So one of them being like motion capture. I learned that at the AIS with Vicon. So that then was like a huge part of my PhD and moving forward. So like technically I learned some things, I think, on that side of things. I also, I think, learned a little bit about structure in terms of I don't know how to say it, but like, all right, so you've got your interns and we've got PhD students and we've got coaches and senior biomechanists, and how to kind of navigate through those waters and who to lean on for advice, I guess. So during that time, those PhD students obviously were like hugely helpful for me and for, I think, a lot of the other interns that year in terms of, okay, they were kind of like the next step for us in our journey. And so a lot of them had been through what we'd been through. So being able to ask them questions and bounce ideas off them was important. And then I think one of the other things I learned was just the general ins and outs of sporting life. So, all right, I'm on the road to Penrith every weekend to go and film canoe kayak. So see you later weekends. Swimming's at 6 a.m. every morning. And, yeah, just the things that I guess they don't tell you about in school, and that, all right, the realities of sport are that they train early morning, evenings, they compete on weekends. And, you know, there's a lot of other things involved in terms of, it's not just capturing your data and watching the game. There's a lot of other things involved in it. So I don't know, it was a very, I think, very important year for me to be able to go through that.
Yeah. After games, late nights are for data analysis. Public holidays are game day.
Yep, always. Yeah, and that's one thing that people say here is like, oh, have you got Sunday off? Well, no, what do you think people want to do on Sunday? They want to go watch a baseball game because they have it off, you know, or same thing with all the holidays and whatnot. So I think being exposed to that applied side of sports science early on and all the ins and outs of sport and, you know, the time dedication that it needs to be for you to be successful, like, I think that was huge. I mean, a lot of people, we talk about it here on a daily basis, like a lot of people just aren't cut out to work in high performance sport. And our medical director here, he sits in the office next to me. He always says, I like to ask people, right, no matter what you do, okay, let's say you're an accountant. I'm going to ask you to work your 8 hours a day. I'm not going to ask you to work 12 hours or 14 hours like I do, but just work your 8 hours a day. And I want you to work 8 hours a day, every day for 3 months. Would you do it? And people always go, well, of course not. And then he says, well, I don't even tell them that 8 hours a day for me is actually 12 hours a day. And then after that 12 hours a day, sometimes I have to get on a plane and travel to another city that's in a different time zone, go to bed at 3 a.m. and then wake up for a game the next day. I am not near my family for 6 months of the year. I'm on the road, you know, all these things. And so he likes to tell that to everyone that, you know, starts working in professional sports. Yeah, he's like, I've seen a lot of people come through, you know, athletic training, sports medicine, strength and conditioning that just don't last because it is like it's a tough lifestyle.
I agree, it is a tough lifestyle, but there must be something that makes stupid people like us keep doing it, right? So give me the good.
I mean, the good is like when you see those young players, like particularly for us, those like young kids that are, you know, fresh out of school or fresh out of college, like, and you see them just grow and grow and grow. And then that one kid next day is in the big leagues and he's hitting a home run, you know, that's the reward, I guess. Like, it's sport. Like, everyone loves sport. Like, the good stories are like incredible.
I couldn't agree more that you're placed in such a position where you can truly change people's lives, and you get to watch those lives change on a big scale in, you know, in moments. And it's amazing. It's amazing to consider that you contributed in a small way to that person's, you know, life, opportunity, you know, growth, success, dreams even.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, you, all of these guys here, like, they all want to reach the major leagues, right? And you think about all those athletes that we worked with, like, their dream was to go to the Olympics, and like, just being able to see them like achieve that, I think is just like, that's what it's for.
Absolutely. It's special. Georgia, one last thing. So you're officially a success as a sports scientist because you've got a cool polo shirt, and you know, you've probably got a bunch of hats with Tigers logos all over them. What advice would you give to a young sports scientist to help them learn or improve, or you know, take your job from you one day?
Well, I think, obviously a lot of the things that we've already talked about, I think find a good mentor. And that can be challenging, I guess. But, you know, like I mentioned earlier, I was lucky enough to go through that system at the AIS and have those opportunities to have people in jobs that I wanted, and, made some awesome friends along the way too, that, you know, now are in very similar jobs to me. And I think that, you know, that's really cool to see that, all right, some of those people that I started with back then at the AIS are also in, you know, similar positions and different sports. And, you know, we have a really nice little network of people. I think that's cool. We talked about networking, but the whole like relationship building, I think that's obviously key. And then just, you got to get on the battleground. You got to get out there. You've got to, however you can, just get exposure to as many sports or job opportunities, internships, whatever it is you can get your hands on, because, you know, you'll get experience, but also you'll meet people. And one of those people that, you know, was your supervisor at whatever football club, hockey club, soccer club, one of these days that person will say, hey, I've got a job going, or hey, my friend who's at, you know, this football club over here is looking for somebody, are you interested? You know, and I think, you know, sports science it's getting pretty popular and big around the world, but also it's still quite a small community, and a lot of, you know, who you know and where you've been and what you've done obviously plays a big part in that. So I think you've just got to do your best to get as much experience and build those relationships as you can.
Hey, stronger truth has never been told, Georgia. That was, absolutely perfect. Thank you so much for your time, your expertise, and joining us here on the Applying Sports Science podcast.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
That was the fourth episode of the Applying Sports Science podcast. A huge thanks to Georgia for her honesty, time, and experience sharing her realities, nuances, and the unwritten rules of applying science to sport. Proudly brought to you by the Human Performance Center as part of the College of Health Sciences at the University of Memphis. Don't forget to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Keep up to date with the Human Performance Center on Twitter and help us keep evolving that relationship between science and sport.